So what do I do? Well, I just add a pinch of wild yeast, and I get that wild yeast from the grapes that I bought from the grocery store, or from the raisins that I have sitting in my cupboard, or from the lentils that I have sort of in the back of my cupboard, right? So those yeasts go in, and just like I was talking about before, yeasts are very, very good at producing a lot of carbon dioxide and producing a lot of alcohol. And they're going to go in there, and they're going to start taking the sugars that are in there, and they're going to start producing alcohol. And they're going to start producing this gas and like all sorts of different acids and flavors and volatile compounds, and it's going to be amazing, amazing.
Welcome to Science for the People. I'm your host, Marion Kilgore. Today, we're discussing a small corner of the wonderful world of yeast. Joining me is Dr. Sudeep Argawala, who obtained his PhD in yeast genetics from MIT and worked at the Whitehead Institute for Biomedical Research before becoming a program director at Ginkgo Bioworks, a synthetic biology company in Boston, Massachusetts. He has also recently started providing sourdough advice on his Twitter account when he learned that some people thought they wouldn't be able to bake bread without store-bought yeast.
Thank you for speaking to me today.
Really, my pleasure. Really, please just punch to be here.
So I think we should probably just start with the very basics. What is yeast? I understand it's a fungi, but that's sort of the extent of what I was taught.
No. It's a great question, and I'm only laughing because that is far from a basic question to ask. But what is yeast? Yeah, good question. It's a eukaryote. It's a fungus. Got a nice solid cell wall on the outside there, which really helps out when you're doing all sorts of different processes with it. But that cell wall can also be a problem when you need to do some complicated biochemistry. You need to break those cells open. When I talk about yeast, I talk about Saccharomyces cerevisiae, which is a brewer's yeast, really baker's yeast. Brewer's yeast is far more of a complicated animal, but in a pinch, those two can be interchanged. And when did yeast become yeast? We go back a few hundred million years, to the single-celled organism. You know, let's use our imagination sitting on the surface of a grape, and it's just starving there and hoping for some sugar. And this organism has done some incredible things. One, either through mating or either through genetic foible, most likely through mating, has gotten two independent genomes inside of its body. And so it's got this whole genome duplication. So it's got double the amount of chromosomes than it normally has. And it's also acquiring the ability to eat different types of sugars, and it's belching out carbon dioxide. And, you know, along this time, it's also learning how to make, your my favorite compound, ethanol. And you know, I like to think about that aspect of it is, you know, I don't know if you have a cat, Marion.
No, I do not.
Well, cats have claws, and the ability to make ethanol is the yeast's claws, right? Because once you make ethanol, and make these different acids, you're able to basically sterilize your local environment. And this is, you know, we look at a grape and we think of a delicious piece of food. Yeast looks at a grape and it says, this is war. Because there's all sorts of other yeasts that are on there. There's also the bacteria, and those different organisms are out to steal its food. And what yeast can do is it can take the sugar in the grape, it can eat it up, and can spit out alcohol and kill off so many other things which are competing for its energy source. So this makes yeast into this really powerful organism. And wherever there's sugar, this yeast can land and start eating things up and killing off other things. So now yeast can go from fruit to different types of grains. You know, grains basically have as their constituent parts long strands of sugar, which yeast can break up, and the grains are also breaking up, and they can eat that sugar. They can go onto different types of material. Anything that has any source of sugar, yeast can land on there and really take advantage of those sugars and its ability to make alcohol and clean off the deck. About 10 to 12,000 years ago, humans were able to exploit this yeast, on its exploit this yeast and start exploiting its ability to make alcohol and to belch out carbon dioxide to make these beautiful loaves of bread that are lofty and round, or this sterilized liquid that is safe to drink even when water isn't. So this is where we start getting wheat beer and wine and bread and different types of breads and different types of leavened lentils, which are now safe to yeast, because I'm so sorry. I keep going on. You're going to have to stop me if I'm going too far.
Because I'm enjoying this. Carry on.
Oh, good. No. Because what else does yeast add? And this is important. Yeast is an important source of vitamins as well. So, you may have heard of Marmite, that was popular during the first war. Marmite is basically yeast, baker's yeast or brewer's yeast. I think most usually brewer's yeast. They take that yeast, they cook it under high pressure and high heat, and they come out with this brown paste. And that brown paste is actually the prototypic multivitamin. And you spread it on your toast, and pregnant women take it by the tiny, tiny spoonfuls. And that's an important source of vitamins and nutrients, the B complex vitamins, which are really, really hard to get if you're on a vegetarian diet, are being now supplied to you through this beer, through this fermented material that humans begin to eat.
You mentioned a yeast cell having, lost track of the wording you used, but basically like twice as much DNA as it normally would.
Yeah, this was a long time ago. As time progresses, it starts to pare down the number of chromosomes and the number of genes that it has to the modern yeast that we have.
Oh, okay. So do they reproduce sexually and asexually?
So the answer is yes, right? So in graduate school, I always used to, I like to pick off my friends who are studying mammalian cells by saying that yeast is the ultimate stem cell, right? Because what happens? You have this individual cell, and it senses enough nutrients in its environment, and it starts to form this tiny little bud. So you can imagine like a balloon, right? And a tiny little bump appears on the surface of that balloon. And as the yeast starts to replicate its DNA, and as the yeast starts to grow and other processes happen, that bud starts to grow and grow and grow until it's at the point where it has two complete sets of chromosomes, and that the protein machinery inside of the cell has pulled the chromosomes from the original yeast cell into this big bud. The original yeast cell will call the mother, and the big bud will call the daughter cell, right? And all of a sudden, pop, the daughter cell sort of buds off, right? And this is why we call the yeast budding yeast. Saccharomyces cerevisiae, the budding yeast, because there are other types of yeast that have different modes of dividing, but this budding morphology has actually allowed us to study how cells, how eukaryotic cells in general, divide, and was really us understanding the proteins that regulate this division was really the first foray into us understanding how mammalian cells divide and what happens when they divide incorrectly. And this is the foundations of our understanding of cancer, right? So, you know, a few minutes ago, I was talking about yeast as a source of culture and of food, but at the very core of it, yeast is also at the center of our understanding of medicine and disease and human biology.
I wouldn't expect that like a yeast cell, a fungal cell, would be a great model for human disease.
Isn't it the most maddening thing? How I love yeast. Not only is it a good model, but our understanding, the proteins that are involved in this type of asexual reproduction are conserved all the way from yeast to mammals. Now, keep in mind there are a bunch more cells, bells and whistles in mammals and in plants, but the sort of organization inside of the cell is so similar to mammalian cells. And you know, as a scientist, the surprising part about all of this is that things that look alike, broadly speaking, things that look very similar tend to behave very similarly, and that's kind of a surprising result. I guess the other part which I haven't told you, we've talked about cancer and mammalian disease, but our understanding of alternative chromosomal structures of, everyone knows about Down syndrome or trisomy 21. But the origins of those alternative chromosomal structures, those are also first identified in yeast. And like, how do we think about that? Well, yeast not only have this beautiful asexual reproduction, but they also have sexual reproduction, in which, you know, this is a science podcast, so I can get into it. You know,
yeah.
When mating type A is in close proximity to mating type alpha, right, and their pheromone signaling pathways are very much intact, they sort of grow towards each other and they form this thing like a zygote. And you know, if this were a TV program and I were to draw a TV a zygote out, you'd immediately have to cut to commercial because it's very phallic looking. yeast forms these zygotes, and these zygotes start budding off diploid cells. Right, so there's a mommy cell and a daddy cell, or an A cell and an alpha cell, and they form these diploid cells, and then there's a transition back from the diploid cells to the haploid cells. So diploids have two copies of the genome, and the haploid cells go back down to one copy of the genome, and the process, that conversion of meiosing the number of chromosomes you have, or reducing the number of chromosomes you have, that process is called meiosis, and the process of meiosis in yeast has such close similarity to meiosis in plants, in humans. We can look at reproductive issues in humans. Much of our understanding of that comes from our understanding of our ability to model these things in yeast, to the level that drugs that work to resolve some of these issues in yeast have their applicability, or you know, yeast is used as a screening mechanism to pare down the drugs that are able to resolve a lot of these issues from yeast all the way through humans, right? And you bobble along other like cell cultures, mouse, simian cell cultures, and then to get it to humans, you have to do quite a few more studies. But yeah, yeast has been used to model all of these things.
I have another basic question.
Please, none of this is basic. It's all been very difficult so far. You're doing great.
are yeasts completely different species of fungi than the kind of fungi that get fuzzy or produce mushrooms? Is there any overlap, or are they just very separate?
Well, they're part of the same kingdom. It's hard to even say. So like, I love roses, and I love to cultivate roses, and you know, when I in my spare time, I have a bunch of different roses, and each of those roses requires slightly different care, right? As anyone of your listeners who like enjoy plants will know that like you have one species of plant that you really enjoy, and but like each one of those takes slightly different care, right?
Yeah.
So it goes with yeast, right? So if you look in a sourdough starter, you have a bunch of different types of yeasts that are acting in the sourdough starter. They each require their special type of tweaks, right? So we call those strains, yeast strains, right? Just like you'd call a rosebush A different, like your Julia Child rosebush, different from the Ebb Tide rosebush, different from the Lady Anne rosebush or rosevine, right? So that's one level, right? And then you start thinking about, well, you know, I like roses, but I enjoy other type of dicotyledonous plants, flowering plants. So maybe I enjoy dogwoods now, right? And I enjoy hawthorns now. Beautiful flowers, right? But they look very, very different. And they're different species, but they look very similar. And similarly with yeast, you know, I have my budding yeast, Saccharomyces cerevisiae, and then I have other types of yeast behave very, very differently, require different media, different caretaking. You know, I have Saccharomyces bionis, I have Picchia pastoris or Comagitale fafii, right? Or I have these other types of things that, you know, on a plate broadly look similar. If you look closely and if you do some interesting experiments, you'll see that they start to behave differently, just like roses behave differently from dogwoods or hawthorns. Maybe this isn't the best explanation, but you get the point. And then you go even farther out, right? Like, and then you start seeing this like fuzzy like little mold on the outside of your plate, or you look at your bread and it's got this lovely red fungus, Neurospora crassa, growing all over it. And if we go back to the analogy of the roses, now you are looking at the fir tree that grows across the street, or you're looking at an orchid which is growing on your desk, right?
Yeah.
Broadly speaking, plants. But they behave very, very differently. And, you know, if you want to smell the flower of a rose, your understanding of what that flower will smell like when you go to a fir tree is completely different, right? Or if you look at a grass, also a plant naturally, but that's going to look very, very different than the blossom on a rose. And similarly, you know, These other fungi, they're all fungi. They, you know, they're things that they have in common, and there's biology that they all have in common. But it's a big gamble when you say, okay, I have this understanding of how it works in Cerevisiae. Will it work the same way when we go to Aspergillus niger or Aspergillus oryzae, right? Like rice fungus or onion fungus. And the question is, sometimes, but also, sometimes not.
Like with baker's yeast.
Yeah.
You had a bit of a viral Twitter thread where you explained to the world how to start a sourdough starter.
Yeah.
So are the yeasts that are going to be cultivated in that sourdough starter, are they the same family of yeast as like your commercial instant baker's yeast or brewer's yeast? Or are they, or are they, you know, sort of different lineages?
So you know, there's another lovely interview that I did for The Spoon, and part of what they were asking about is like, what else can you do with it? What else can you do with the sourdough? And like just really thinking about like yeasts in general. And I think one thing that I said there, which I keep repeating, and like I'm almost on the verge of believing myself, so you know, shame on me. But like, yeast is technology. Yeast, the identification, the ability to identify yeast and to exploit that yeast for different purposes, that's all technology. In that line, right? Like, how did all this come about? Because 12,000 years ago, we didn't have microscopes, and we didn't know what was going on. In fact, up until when was Leeuwenhoek? 18th century, right? We didn't really know what was going on in these tiny things. And the word yeast we get comes from Dutch, which is, and it refers to the foam that comes up at the bottom of your beer. And if you take that foam, and you incubate it with other sugar sources, with flour, right? You get this lovely rising, right? What people found is that these different types of leavening agents, you could isolate them and you could purify them out. So these big yeast houses, Lallemand or Le Saff, they've been around for more than a century. And what they were really good at is that they were able to isolate different types of yeast. Now, not all of them are Cerevisiae. A lot of these are sort of mixed lineages where, you know, yeast got a little flirtatious with a species right next door, and lo and behold, they form a diploid and a diploid cell, which is, you know, not exactly yeast and not exactly species X, right? But that's okay, because that species is that new sort of diploid cell is able to survive under these new conditions. This happens a lot for beer brewing, and it happens a little bit for bread baking too. But bread baking is not as stressful as being in a beer vat, and we can get into that a little bit. But what you're able to do is you're able to isolate out these different strains, and you're able to test their ability to bake bread, test their ability to survive high levels of sugar, test their ability to gas small balls of dough in a certain amount of time. And this is where you have the professional industrial yeast, right? They grow well in your fermentation vessels. They are able to gas your cells. They gas your bread very, very nicely. They are able to be stored at 4 degrees centigrade for years, and then bounce right back at a moment's notice, so that you can, you know, it's Thursday night and you have to bake your challah, and you don't want to wait around for 2 days for your loaf to leaven, right? Right. Yeah, and like this is where we develop our professional yeast. But a moment of thought for the beautiful cultures that you're harvesting off the grapes and harvesting off your flour and harvesting off your hands and having grown in your starters, in your cultures. Because, you know, as much as a fan I am of, you know, Lesoth Gold, right, and its ability to sort of leaven my high sugar doughs on Thursday nights when I'm baking challah, you know, there is something beautiful and marvelous about this community of yeast which you've harvested in your own kitchen, these wild yeasts, which are different from, you know, I'm in Boston. I actually don't know where you're recording from.
I'm in Edmonton, Alberta, so quite a bit north.
Quite a bit north. And like the yeast which is in your air and in your fruit are going to be slightly different, right?
Yeah.
And the community that you are able to harvest is going to be so different. And the bread that you bake will have these slight differences in flavors.
Actually, let's just talk about sourdough for a bit. So,
please.
So you had a few suggestions for different ways of getting yeast, getting a sourdough starter going. And one of them was like taking dried fruit and soaking it in water and then using that water with your flour to get yeast into that mix.
Uh-huh.
Are the yeasts that you're taking off of that fruit likely to be the strains that stay in the flour, or are they just sort of holding the fort until other ones colonize it?
Oof. Good question. So the yeast that let's talk about the standard method of making sourdough,
okay,
which is you
yes.
take water and you take flour, right? And you just let it sit on your counter and you see what pops up. Heaven help me, I'm not a patient man. That works. That works great if you're in a slightly warm area or you have a warm kitchen. You will get something. It'll be wonderful. But me, I'm an impatient man, and I just want to get, like, you know, if I have something going and I want to be able to bake, like, I don't plan my experiments ahead of time very well, much to the consternation of people who work around me. And I don't like to plan my bakes, very well either, right? So what do I do? Well, I just add a pinch of wild yeast, and I get that wild yeast from the grapes that I bought from the grocery store, or from the raisins that I have sitting in my cupboard, or from the lentils that I have sort of in the back of my cupboard, right? So those yeasts go in. And just like I was talking about before, yeasts are very, very good at producing a lot of carbon dioxide and producing a lot of alcohol. And they're going to go in there and they're going to start immediately taking the sugars that are in there, and they're going to start producing alcohol. And they're going to start producing this gas and like all sorts of different acids and flavors and volatile compounds. And it's going to be amazing, amazing. To get to your question, right? Like, are they sort of like setting up shop, or are they holding the fort, right? Like, gosh, Marian, I hate to say it, but this is war, right? Like, this is a matter of survival, right? Like, the yeast are not there to make friends. It's reality TV.
It's every yeast for itself.
Every yeast for itself, and every offspring of that yeast for itself, and you know they're not there to make friends. But here's what will happen, right? Like, Say you get your yeast off your grape and you put it into your water, and you have a bunch of different types of yeast in there. And then say you get tired of drinking tap water and you use filtered water, right? And the composition of that filtered water is going to be slightly different from the composition of your tap water. And you put that in. Well, let me just tell you, you have just created natural selection within your sourdough. And some of the yeast which flourish in tap water are going to be slower to divide because they don't have the magical ingredient, which is in Alberta water, right?
Right.
In order to thrive. And those aren't going to grow as well. And all of a sudden, this entire wave of new yeasts are going to take over. And then you go to the grocery store, as many of us are doing right now, and we say, like, oh, actually, my favorite type of flour is not there. I guess I'll just have to use a different type of flour, right? So instead of white flour, you now go to wheat flour. Well, let me tell you, that wheat flour is going to give a very different profile of nutrients to your sourdough than what the white flour was. And all of a sudden, you've created another wave of selection in your sourdough, which, you know, some yeasts are going to thrive and other yeasts are not going to thrive. So, like, listen, it. Again, this is going to get me into trouble, but like, you are playing God with your sourdough, and you should own up to it, right? Because there's nothing you can do to control these things at the level that they need to. And in fact, this is part of the reason that makes sourdough such a magical thing, which is only able to be created in your kitchen. If you go to the grocery store, yeah, you can buy sourdough, but what they've done in that sourdough is they've taken, you know, our industrial professional yeast, and they've made a loaf of bread with it, and they've tossed in a little vinegar so it tastes sour. It's not the same sourdough that you're going to make in your kitchen. And why is that? Industrial bakers, they want to work with the professional yeast that are going to give you the same type of oven spring, that are going to give you the same type of proofing time, that you don't have to worry about the temperature changes in your kitchen. Or in the bread baking plant, and you don't have to worry about adjusting the amount of flour or water you add according to humidity. They right. just want something they can put into their bread line or into their automated line and have a loaf of bread be made, right?
Right.
And it's fine.
You don't need to correct for it as you go.
Exactly. Exactly. And you don't need to correct for this, like, this beautiful thing that you are playing God with in your kitchen counter, according to the different types of yeast which have taken over, because you can't maintain it. So, like, being able to make a loaf of sourdough in your kitchen, that's sort of like a really powerful thing to do, because it's not something that it's still something which people have not figured out how to do industrially.
Okay, right.
Like, I have my ideas. You know, bread makers of the world, if you want to know how to make industrial sourdough, let's talk. Right, but but right now, the thing that people are doing all over the U.S. right now, and the Canada too, I imagine, making these sourdoughs, right? Like, it is one of the few things that you can do better than other professional baking units, with the exception of your neighborhood bakery, who doesn't necessarily care about being able to have as high a reproducibility as an automated baking process has, and is making small batch sourdoughs on a massive scale, of course, much more massive than you would be in your own kitchen. But like, this is where the artisanal is still powerful and a useful thing to be.
Moving a little ways away from sourdough, or probably quite a ways away, I ran across articles, and I hadn't realized this, that in the 1980s, they were genetically engineering yeast. A lot of insulin is produced by this genetically modified yeast. Is yeast easy to tweak?
This is one of the beautiful things. Yes, you're absolutely right. A lot of two major things are produce our most of our insulin right now. So, like, when I certainly don't know how old you are, but I'm 37. My parents' generation were getting their insulin from pig pancreases, right? So you mm-hmm. go to the butcher and you get your pig pancreas, and, like, you know, all this awful that people they couldn't sell to consumers, they'd sell to places, and they'd isolate the proteins. But now we have recombinant technology in which we're able to put these snippets of DNA for human insulin into E. coli or into yeast, right? So I believe it's Novo Nordisk is the leading producer of insulin, of recombinant insulin produced in Saccharomyces cerevisiae right now. And what yeast is really good at doing, probably the best at doing, of the organisms that I know, you know, don't at me, but I'm sure I'm wrong at this, but like, of the organisms that I know, yeast is really good at this process called homologous recombination. And what goes on in homologous recombination? Well, you give the yeast a piece of DNA, and we figured out good ways of introducing yeast DNA into a yeast cell, and this DNA looks like parts. The DNA that we've given to them is, say, mostly human DNA, but the very edges of this snippet of DNA has homology, or is homologous to bits of DNA that the yeast already has in its genome. So, what happens when the yeast sees this piece of DNA? Well, first of all, it says, "Holy crap! there is DNA in my cells. It looks like broken DNA. Everyone, stop what you're doing. We have to fix this, right? So the yeast, we've tricked the yeast into thinking that there's broken DNA in its cells. Fine. All these different proteins are going to then take this broken DNA and they're going to try to say, oh my gosh, oh my gosh, oh my gosh, where are we going to put this piece of broken DNA inside of our cell, right? And it does this search, and like the very details of this have, you know, we've known that this happened for decades. The very details of this we're still trying to figure out, but it finds the matching piece of DNA inside of its own genome and is able to put in the outside DNA into its inside DNA very, very cleanly, so that it sort of like stitches everything in almost perfectly into its native genome, right?
Oh,
and,
okay.
And this is engineering yeast for this reason is very, very clean, and being able to make these modifications by knowing exactly where the DNA goes is something which we have been doing for almost 50 years now.
I didn't realize that this technique was just taking advantage of the yeast's repair mechanisms to like put the DNA where it made sense.
Exactly.
Oh, okay.
And you know, in mammalian cells or other organisms, right? Like you introduce a piece of DNA, and you know the cells are a bit messy about it. And they'll say, "Okay, we'll get around to it. We'll just stash it in some part of our genome. We won't tell you where, but you can figure it out if you sequence our entire genome." Great. That's you know. I don't like doing that type of thing because I'm slightly neurotic when it comes to making my strains. The beauty of yeast is that you can know exactly where that DNA went, and majority of the time it goes in, with notable exceptions, of course. There's some regions which are hard to target. But yeast, you can make very precise modifications to the genome, very, very simply.
Once your intended piece of DNA has gotten slotted into the yeast genome and the yeast is off doing its thing, is the intent that it sort of, while it's off, you know, growing and budding and eating sugars, it's also this chunk of DNA is telling it to also produce whatever, insulin precursors or different types of alcohols or something like that?
Yeah, good question. And like, this is where I'm taking off my biomedical researcher hat and putting on my, you know, bioengineering top hat. I'm putting on my bioengineering beanie, right? You can imagine multiple different types of ways of expressing this DNA, right? One of the things which is great about having this sort of like entire cultural history about yeast is that we know how to play with yeast, right? We know how to manipulate, you know, as a beer brewer, we know how to manipulate yeast in these massive tanks and have known how to manipulate yeast in these massive tanks for centuries, right? We know how yeast breathes, right? And that might sound like a weird thing to say, but like yeast takes up oxygen and releases carbon dioxide if you play with it right. And we know with these industrial strains, we know exactly how to manipulate those industrial strains. And with the advent of recombinant DNA technology, we've been able to identify the snippets of DNA that respond to these different cues that we give it, right? So you can imagine having yeast growing in a tank, and all of a sudden you splash in a different sugar source, and the yeast start behaving differently, right?
Mm-hmm.
So the beauty of recombinant DNA technology is that we know the snippets of DNA that are responsive to this, and we can take these snippets of DNA, and we can have them drive our favorite protein. Right. And this is sort of where the creativity in being a scientist, the creativity in being a yeast geneticist, of being a biological engineer, this is the fun part. And this is the bit that I sort of get excited by, right? Because now you can engineer the yeast to produce a different protein, to be responsive to different sugar sources, to produce different alcohols, to make different types of flavors or fragrances. The world is your oyster at this point, because you know how to control the expression of these genes in exquisitely tightly regulated ways.
I learned so many things while researching for this episode.
Oh, good. Excellent.
I had no idea that yeast could be used to produce, you know, aromatic compounds for perfumes and all the other household things that we put scents in these days. Is that sometimes more efficient than the traditional sources that you would have from, say, flowers or herbs or whatever?
Yeah. This is where our conversation starts taking a very dark turn. And it goes back to something that I said before. Yeast is technology, right? We apply it towards culture. We apply it towards making sourdough, or we apply it towards making pizza, or apply it towards making wine or beer, right? Or making dosas or dhokla, right? Each of those are very, very different. But fundamentally, yeast is a technology that we apply for different things. And it's literally within the past 50 years that we've been able to apply it towards issues that are affecting us, right? So you yourself mentioned insulin with yeast, and that happened in the 80s. And now what we're finding, and like I certainly don't know the politics of the listeners of your show, and you know I certainly have my own politics, but I wish it weren't a political issue, but it turns out to be a political issue. But there is an undeniable economic impact to climate change. Mm-hmm. That regardless of whether you believe in climate change or not, the economics are very, very clear. That if you are a perfumier, or if you produce different types of flavors from natural sources, you are freaking out because your local ecology has changed so much that your plants are dying, or right. that what was once so abundant and so easy to come by has become incredibly, incredibly difficult to come by. And it is actually cheaper, and it allows you to have much more control over the product that you're getting, because it's not just a matter of producing a vanilla scent or a rose scent, right? Because depending on the different conditions of the growth of the plant and the different like rain patterns in your local area, it's going to change the different fragrances that plant is producing as well, and the different compounds that they're producing, right? So in order to be able to be certain of the product that you're going to be delivering to a growing global need for vanilla, for perfumes, other different types of foods, it is becoming increasingly less able. You are becoming increasingly less able to do that from natural sources. So like, this is the tragic part of my job, and like, this is, I don't know if I'd much rather be out of a job than solve this. I do enjoy getting a paycheck. But like what we do at Ginkgo Bioworks is we are very good at taking the genes from the original plants, from the original organisms, and taking those snippets of DNA, figuring out what those snippets of DNA do, and then we can put it into our favorite microorganism. My personal favorite is yeast, but there's all sorts of different microorganisms that we can introduce DNA into. And we can then tickle the cell just right so that it starts producing the compound that you need, right, for fragrances, for flavors. And this is a way of ensuring that the world as we know it, which is, I think, undeniably changing in ways that we are unfamiliar with, being able to extend the tail on that world.
If you're used to growing something in a certain climate and suddenly it's warmer and sometimes drier but sometimes flooding, I can see the allure of moving that production into something that looks sort of like a brewery, right? It's indoors, it's climate controlled, you know what you're going to get out at the end.
Exactly. And you can have your yeast growing exactly the way you want. And if you don't need it anymore, you know, one would hope that at some point you don't need it anymore. You can switch off to a different source.
With the biological engineering side of this, the like, I guess, under normal circumstances, day to day of it, are we at the point now with this technology where people can basically like put together a purchase order that says, I would like a yeast or an E. coli or whatever that produces this flavor compound originally found in this plant, you know?
Yeah.
Make me a yeast.
This is not just Ginkgo Bioworks. This is the exciting part about being in biotechnology now, because you say, oh, I want an E. coli strain that produces this protein. I want a yeast strain that produces this fragrance. Before, being able to identify the piece of DNA and being able to shape those pieces of DNA so that they express well in your favorite microorganism, that was a multi-year, multi-million dollar project. Part of what I love about being at Ginkgo and part of what I love about being in biotechnology in our current age is that we have made being able to do chemical synthesis of DNA, so being able to get the snippets of DNA that we know and want and know will work, that has become really, really cheap. Being able to scour through all the DNA sequences that we've collected in the entire world and figure out, okay, this protein looks like it's going to work, this protein is not going to work, that has become, I won't say trivial because I don't want to diminish the incredible talent of the field that it is right now, but it's become a conceivable project. It has become a bolus of work that, you know, even 10 years ago would have seemed astronomically difficult. That has become something that we can wrap our head around and work on. So all of these issues, being able to screen through hundreds of thousands of different yeast strains of, you know, hundreds of thousands of different proteins, it is now a problem that we can grapple with. And, you know, should I wouldn't say a consumer, but a company say that we need this yeast strain or E. coli strain or other bacterial strain or other fungal strain to produce this particular compound, it is now something that we're able to do, where even when I was in graduate school, which was a long time ago, but not that long ago, right? It seemed like a complete impossibility. And like the world is changing in like really spectacular ways. And this is also, you know, it's also why it's a really exciting time to be in biotechnology and in this field of metabolic engineering.
People tend to feel strongly about knowing what's in their food.
Yeah.
And I suspect there are some people who are uncomfortable listening to this, realizing that some of the stuff in their day-to-day life that hadn't even occurred to them might involve genetic engineering, involves genetic engineering.
So I get it. And like, listen, I hate to be sort of squirrely about this, but like, I just don't know how to go about this any other way, right? Like, earlier I said that yeast is technology, right? Mm-hmm. And the second half of that statement is that flour is culture. I've been saying that in terms of sourdough, right? That like, you cannot be a scientist in the world and not think about these questions, right? Let's talk about why everyone's baking bread. And I think we'll get around to this GMO question very, very quickly, surprisingly quickly, right? Like, why? And like, yeah, I'll interview you for a second. Like, why are people baking bread, Marian?
Well, I think the sort of surface reason is that they're home and they're having trouble finding instant yeast, and they want some sort of comfortable activity to do that makes them feel like they're being useful and they're doing something they wouldn't normally do, but now they have time for it, and it's sort of it's something that connects you, right, to your food.
Yeah, no, and I think we're agreed on that. And like, I think part of that is good and okay and healthy, because I think that same instinct about it is rough, I'm in a tough spot right now, and all I want is a loaf of bread, is the same instinct that says, gosh, I just wish I had a bottle of perfume that had my favorite rose scent in it, that I know where the rose is. Or I wish I had a bottle of vanilla paste on my shelf where I could see the vanilla seed that's sitting at the bottom of it, right? Because reality means something.
Right.
I can tell you that I can produce a yeast strain that produces a fragrance down to the molecule, right? The one part, parts per million, parts per million, identical to stuff which is being extracted from other sources, right? We can we have the technology to do that sort of thing, but reality matters, and the fact that it's And the fact that it's not being that we don't feel the soft petals of the rose when we put it on our skin, and when we know that it's been produced from yeast, or the fact that the vanilla that we are tasting, right? We don't have the images of these plantations on Madagascar, right? Each vanilla having been pollinated by hand. I don't think you can ignore that, right? And that type of reality is important. And you know, this again goes back to what I was talking about. That fundamentally, yeast is a technology, and we need to have a discussion that can't be tainted by the pro scientists versus the anti scientists about what reality is and what reality should be, but to have an honest conversation about how is technology affecting our culture?
Yeah.
In a meaningful way. But like, there's some real feelings there. And now is the time to have that conversation. Especially when we're on this cusp of being able to do amazing things.
Right. Let's as a society, figure out what we want the technology to do before we set it loose to do it.
Or decide that we're not going to decide that as a society, right? Like, let's figure out. There's a problem here that needs to be resolved, and you know, I say this as a scientist. I'm not certain that coming out like guns blazing with technology is necessarily the way to address this issue.
So one of the other sort of questions that always comes up with GMOs is, you know, what if the genetically modified one gets out into the world? Is that much of a risk with yeasts? We've been messing around with brewing yeast for hundreds of years, but I don't know that anyone's too worried if they start floating in the wind.
Like, part of what amazes me, and part of the reason I love thinking about yeast, is because we have this millennia old technology, you know, 12,000 years. Right, like, do you read 4000 BCE? You look at the Epic of Gilgamesh, right? Enkidu only becomes civilized after he drinks beer and eats bread, right? These are the markers of civilization, right? The fact that it is showing up in texts that we have from 4000 years ago shows how fundamental yeast technology is, right? And what great respect yeast technology is regarded at that time, right?
Right.
It is such a fundamental piece of technology that, for better or for worse, without having this broad global discussion about technology, got adopted, right? And maintained. And now we're at this other cusp of now the entire world is talking to each other, and now that makes it harder because the utility doesn't reign, right? We have a cultural aspect to talk about. And right. I think that's important to talk about.
Yeah.
This question about what happens if it leaks out, you know, there's no way to say for certain. Some modifications, I know, make the yeast not as fit as their wild counterparts parts. Others may or may not, right? But to come out and say like, oh, don't worry about it, right? That's an irresponsible cultural thing to do, because it doesn't address the reason people are asking this question, right? The reason you're asking that question is because you may actually be kind of afraid, right? And by me being patronizing and saying, oh, don't worry, they're there. Right? Like, cui bono, right? Like, what does that help? But on the flip side, I'm not going to say, listen, the world's going to end if a yeast cell escapes these things, because they're two extremes, and the truth lies somewhere in the middle. As a responsible geneticist, I like to think that the truth lies more towards the end of it's not the end of the world, right?
Mm-hmm.
And that we have fail safes in place, that we have fail safes in place to make sure that things getting out in the world will be controlled. But this is, there is a reason that Jurassic Park got made, right? That the lysine salt blocks, all of a sudden these dinosaurs find a way to get around it. And in the immortal words of Jeff Goldblum, life finds a way. And like, I'm being glib, and I apologize because I suspect that you and a lot of your listeners are deeply concerned about this sort of thing, to some extent or not. But like, yeah.
So you mentioned that yeast likes to trade genes with other strains nearby. So the stuff that you do in the lab might get out in the world. It might not. It's how would you, who knows?
Yeah. Well, I mean, so let me turn a little wonky and say like horizontal gene transfer. And what that means is that a snippet of DNA jumps from one organism or is introduced from one organism directly into another organism. That happens in bacteria all the time. Bacteria are promiscuous, and they have ways of directly sucking up DNA from another bacteria. Eukaryotes are a bit more reserved in their interest in swapping DNA. Sorry. No, eukaryotes are a bit more reserved, right? So like, you can mate. Like, you may be able to mate with some other things. Being able to have the DNA jump from one organism to another for eukaryotes, as a general rule, less likely. Bacteria, they do this type of stuff all the time. So there, I can say that, like, yes, snippets of DNA aren't necessarily going to jump from one organism to another organism in the blink of an eye. You're gonna have to be a little thoughtful about life cycle processes there. That said, they're still able to mate, and they're still able to cross into different backgrounds. And we should be sensitive about that. And let's be reasonable and assume a reasonable worst case scenario. Not the fact that yeast are going to turn into bacteria. That's not a reasonable worst case scenario. But like, what happens if they're able to mate in the wild and produce some reasonable scenarios?
Changing topics a little bit. Do you have a favorite, I guess, I was going to ask, do you have a favorite strain of yeast? But I think we already covered that. That's like the baking and brewer's yeast.
Well, that's not true. How much time you got? No. Because, you know, there are, when you think of yeast, you think of these glossy types of yeast that sort of sit on the auger of your petri dish. And like, that's fine. They do a lot of interesting things. Very useful. Lovely. Love working with them. If you go into the wild and you, even your sourdough, if you get your sourdough off of, especially fruit, and you cultivate those yeast and then you streak for singles onto a petri dish, right? And you can have specific selections so that you get your, the right yeast out of there, you're going to find all sorts of weird type of yeast morphologies coming out of them. You're going to get these weird wrinkly colonies. You're going to find these colonies with these weird edges to them. And, you know, it's those types of yeast which are absolutely fascinating, because when you start to stress those yeast out, you get these beautiful colony morphologies. So part of my graduate work was studying pseudohyphae and sort of like filament formation in yeast. And, you know, we had this long conversation about like, what does yeast look like when it divides? All of that goes outside the book, goes out of the book once you start playing around with these wild yeasts that you can cultivate off these fruits. And this is one of the things which I just don't know how to communicate to all these people who are writing to me on Twitter, is the amazing diversity that they have in their hands and how exciting that absolutely is. And like, if only I could like bring everyone into a lab and like we could have a yeast course for like a week. You would never ever ever go back to these boring but powerful industrial yeasts that are coming in these Fleischmann's packets. It's they're really spectacular yeasts, these wild yeasts.
it's a sort of world of diversity and beauty that you just don't necessarily think about unless you're looking at them regularly under a microscope, I suspect.
Or unless you're eating them, right? Like, you're eating this community of beautiful bacteria and yeast sitting on your counter. And like I said before, right? In industrial bakers have not been able to figure that out just yet. It is just you and your neighborhood bakery that can really produce that in a meaningful way. You should be proud of that.
I love that image. It's great.
Yeah, it's kind of heartwarming. It's a big baking hasn't taken over yet. So, like, here's one to end on, right? Like, I don't mean to be an evangelist like this, but like, this idea of yeast being technology, let's be really meaningful about calling yeast technology, because there are some things that yeast can solve. There are other things that yeast cannot solve, right? Yeast can solve this problem of I need something to leaven my bread with. Yeast can solve this problem of, okay, economically it's unsustainable to keep harvesting this rare flour from our shores, so we're going to take the genes and put it into that. That's the solutions of yeast. But like, I think we also really need to be very careful about the cultural impact of that, right? And as a scientist, I can tell you how yeast can be used as technology, but what I hope as a scientist is that everyone else is doing the work of thinking about what this technology means.
That is a very thoughtful place to end.
Listen, I really, really appreciate you reaching out like this. This has been such a pleasure.
Thank you so much for your time.
You can learn more about Dr. Argawalla and find links to information about his work with yeast and his sourdough instructions at our website, scienceforthepeople.ca. Thanks for joining us, and we'll see you next week on Science for the People.
Science for the People is listener-supported. You can find us on Patreon, where you can support us with monthly donations in any amount. Your support keeps us afloat and able to keep making great new episodes, and we thank you for it. The show is produced by Rochelle Saunders and edited by Ryan Bromsgrove. We get help with special projects from K.O. Myers. Our theme song was written and recorded by Fractal Pattern, and its title is Binary Consequence. The show is hosted by Bethany Brookshire, Anika Hazra, Marion Kilgour, and me, Rochelle Saunders.